Hello and welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that delves into the heart of food service equipment and the hospitality sector. I'm here today in London, back in our studios in Canary Wharf, and it's January. We're sort of back end of the New Year celebrations, I suppose. And I'm joined by two gentlemen. One, Neil Painter, who's actually the group maintenance director for Big Mama Restaurants. For those who don't know Big Mama Restaurants, they've got brands like Jacuzzi, and we're going to get into those brands and the concepts and what they do. I'm also joined by Richard Fordham, who's the managing director of Synchrotronic Intelligent Energy Management Systems and actually sponsor for this podcast. So without further ado, let's get on with the show. Neil, welcome to the show. Happy New Year. Can we say that now?
I think so. We're still within the first week, so
Okay, so great. So, yeah, how was Christmas?
It was great, thank you. Yeah, it was a good break. I spent some time up in Scotland with my wife's family, so yeah, it wasn't too cold. I think that's slightly changing now as they face into a bit of the snow. But no, it was great. It was a great break. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us and coming on the show. Before we kind of get into Big Mama Restaurants, obviously your role, you're the maintenance director. It's quite a big position there in the business. Let's talk about you as a person, if you don't mind. Where did you grow up, and what was kind of like the environment of your childhood and that sort of thing?
So I grew up in Reigate in Surrey, and sort of moved to Devon with my parents. My family relocated when I was 15. Okay. So a bit of a strange age, if I'm honest, to relocate. I wasn't the most academic of people, so I had a final year of school in Devon, so managed to line up most of my options with similar options down there. One of the things that did have to change was the fact that when we ran out of courses and I had to take on a rural science course. So I was taught to drive a tractor and do various other things on the farm, which was fantastic. But yeah, so I grew up in an environment where my dad was very practical, did a lot of DIY around the house. So I had a general interest in sort of building things and, you know, sort of mending my bike and things like that. But I left school at 16 and went to work at the age of 16. So
okay, just straight into what was that first job?
So I joined the old YTS scheme, as it was.
We're in modern apprenticeship now, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah. And it was great. It sort of gave me a role, if you like, whilst I thought I was going to join the fire brigade, and that was my plan. And you couldn't join until you were 18. There was no way I was going to do A-levels at school. As I said, I wasn't that academic. And therefore, I just really wanted to find a suitable job. And I was invited to join the YTS by the local council, Devon County Council. And that was because I did my work experience there. So I had a slight interest in property, land surveying, I thought. But I did my work experience in the winter, and it was a little bit cold and wet. So when the opportunity came up to work in their maintenance team, I took the opportunity.
Okay, so that's kind of where you got into that really quite early on, really.
Exactly. So I've always worked in property.
Right, yeah. Okay. So, and obviously coming from your father as well. So was hospitality, you know, moving into hospitality, was that a deliberate career choice or something that an opportunity came up?
Definitely an opportunity came up. So I'd spent an awful lot of time following on from working in Devon County Council. I spent quite a lot of time in retailing. I was lucky enough to be able to take a career break whilst I was at Devon County Council and do my building surveying degree. Mm-hmm. So I had that background in surveying, I suppose. And then an opportunity came up to go into retailing. And I spent probably 15, 20 years, I suppose, on the retailing side. I then had an opportunity to join Nando's, and I joined them, and I spent nearly 13 years with them.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Great time. Really enjoyed it there.
Was that quite the start of their boom?
They'd got to around 250 restaurants at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was certainly a time when they were becoming much more sort of known throughout the country, I suppose. I mean, they already had a good spread.
Yeah.
But yeah, they managed to get some great celebrity endorsement, and that really, I think, elevated the brand even further.
Yeah.
So yeah, good fun times there. Really enjoyed it. joined there as a sort of facilities manager, if you like, and then worked my way through there to take on, you know, elements such as refurbishment and obviously the CapEx work that we did there as well. And then joined Big Mama from there.
Okay. So, and your early work time, if you like, how did that kind of shape your ethics and, you know...
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I did realise is it was useful to have, you know, the degree behind me and make sure that I was confident, I suppose, in terms of my role and being able to own the role that I did. And I think that's always been really important, that, you know, the ownership and taking on the responsibility of whatever your role looks like. And one of the things I learnt early on was obviously to just check and double check your numbers and your calculations, and you know, that's something that sticks with me fully now. I mean, I can't sleep at night if the spreadsheet numbers don't add up at the bottom of the page. So
Okay. And what attracted you specifically to the Big Mama group, if you like? Because how many restaurants?
So we've got 34 restaurants that I look after.
Oh, wow, okay.
Across 8 countries. So there's about 9,000 covers in total. So it's growing and growing fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
The key opportunity for me was being able to work globally. That was the difference to where I'd been. I was enjoying my role at Nando's, and so it's a great business to be part of. I just felt like I had another sort of challenge in me that I wanted to explore.
And, so what countries are they operating in?
So mainly through Europe. Okay. So France, Spain, Italy, Germany, Belgium, obviously the UK, now in Ireland. We've just opened in Dubai as well. Now pushed outside.
And you look after all the...
So I'm responsible for all of those restaurants.
Wow, yeah, okay. So real difference in compliance and regulation and... contractors and
absolutely. And I think that's the that's been the interesting learning curve, I suppose, is understanding different cultures, the challenge around language barriers. Typically I don't have the strongest language skills. And I'm absolutely wowed by the abilities, I suppose, of my colleagues across the business in terms of how they will switch from one language to another. And it's incredible to watch and listen to as well. So
before you joined, did you sort of know the sort of size of the job, if you like, and the enormity of it? Or
I think I hadn't. Well, I obviously had an expectation. I don't think I fully appreciated some of the challenges that I found working in a global context, and certainly the challenge around, you know, translating and retranslating, you know, documents and communications, and the time that takes.
Yeah,
and then also the fact that, you know, as a result of that, there can be, you've got to recheck, I suppose, what the intention, what the language or the email or the communication is actually saying. So, you know, things get lost in translation.
Yes,
and I think really easy to
see.
So making sure you're interpreting correctly, absolutely. And then again, rereading what you're putting back and just trying to understand how someone else might interpret what you're trying to say. And I think it always helps. Yeah, at least if you can. I mean, I try and translate as much as I can back into someone else's language so they receive it at least in their language, because
yes,
I think that little effort makes a massive difference in terms of how you engage and build relationships with people.
Definitely. So, I mean, we're going to get sort of go back on about your actual role as maintenance director, but for people that don't know Big Mama as a business, I mean, I think probably they know the brands, but maybe not Big Mama as a name. Could you sort of describe the business and maybe a couple of the concepts?
Yeah. So as a business, we run Italian trattorias, and our ambition is to make them as authentic as possible. Yeah. So we employ an awful lot of Italians through the business, which is great. They bring a huge amount of energy to the business, and that's fantastic. We also produce our own products, so our own homemade pastas and pizza doughs, and again, it drives that authenticity. We are aiming to bring affordable luxury, if you like, to people. The concepts are different. So we have different restaurants. Every restaurant has its own uniqueness, not only from design, but also on the menu as well. So the menus will at least slightly differ from restaurant to restaurant. Okay. And actually across the various different restaurants that we operate, there is quite a broad range of menus available. And then it's, as I say, it's about creating a great experience for customers and hopefully leaving them with some amazing memories as well.
Okay. And a couple of brands, a couple of restaurant names we might, yeah, so might recognise.
In London, you've got Cercle Popolari. Okay. We've also got Jacuzzi, Carlotta. Recently opened Barbarella in Canary Wharf.
Yeah.
And then outside of London, we've expanded now into Manchester and into Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And then obviously we have restaurants in those other countries that we discussed.
And it's fair to say the restaurants, they are beautifully designed. I mean, interior perspective. Like, you go in, it can be like, when I went to Jacuzzi, I was like, wow, you know, it's a lot. There's a lot going on, not just in the food, but in the visuals and the service, and it's a real...
Absolutely. I mean, it is about creating an atmosphere. An atmosphere comes from, you know, good food, from, you know, great people, and obviously from design as well. So that's exactly the experience we want people to have, is to feel wowed.
Okay. We're just coming almost to the end of this section. We're just going to touch a little bit about energy and cost, because obviously we've got Synchrotronic here today. So energy, gas... It's huge cost now. I mean, ever since, really since COVID, but obviously since conflicts across the world, you know, it's a massive expense for business. Is that on your agenda, your remit, or is that a different department? Or, you know, how important is energy in your business, I suppose?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's rocketed up people's agendas, I think, over the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah, we were, I think, you know, lucky to have some, you know, very cheap sort of energy availability sort of 6-7 years ago. And I think, people fell into a bit of complacency with it. And then suddenly, you know, we've had the challenges of the last 4 or 5 years. And that's increased people's costs enormously. And it's created a lot of shock, I think, through businesses as a result. So, it's naturally high on the agenda, I think, of every business out there. Certainly for us, it's high on our agenda. It is part of my remit as well. We are a B Corp organisation, so it falls, as part of that scope to be reporting. And, I think just from a responsibility point of view, it's massively important that we manage the resources that we've got available to us as well.
Yeah.
In terms of where it sits on the... my scope, we are actively looking at opportunities for where we can, sort of save energy costs, reduce our energy consumption. We've done a couple of trials this year by introducing heat recovery into a couple of the restaurants. And it will be different for us from restaurant to restaurant in terms of what the opportunities look like. Our restaurants are spread across Europe and obviously into Dubai, and what's right in the UK won't necessarily be right in Dubai. We've got different challenges. So I think we have to stay flexible and stay open-minded in terms of what the opportunities are and explore them and see how we can best sort of manage that going forward.
Is this like the sort of biggest source of energy waste do you see in hospitality, or is that too broad?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is what's the cost of doing business, because actually we have to use energy and we have to use a reasonable amount of energy to be able to just open our restaurants. It's as simple as that. Beyond that, though, it's about how do we then sort of understand where our opportunities lie. So, naturally within kitchen equipment, within heating and cooling systems, they're going to be our highest sort of users of energy, and therefore our focus has got to be in and around those areas to be able to sort of look at opportunities and where we can find some solutions and opportunities to save energy, and also looking at behaviours within the teams as well, and how do we help them to understand what their part it looks like in terms of energy management as well.
Is there anything that frustrates you about energy in the hospitality sector? Things you hear or people saying things or not really?
I think
the frustration I think most businesses, I suppose, would have would be if their teams come in and don't do what they would do at home. Yeah, if actually, when you leave a room at home, you turn the lights off. You don't leave the tap running. You don't leave the gas on. You don't, you know, you don't try and use the oven to heat your house, sort of thing. It's but actually, some of those behaviours do then change when you get into a work environment. Mm-hmm. So, how do you help people to understand that actually you've got the knowledge, you know what the right thing is to do, and just be thinking that way? I think, you know, in terms of when they turn up at work, you know, they still have that responsibility. And actually, I think when you look at, you know, the teams that we employ now and you know, the workforce that's coming through, I mean, they've been brought up on energy saving and their awareness to it, they're much more sensitive to it. So how do we, you know, actually, how do we show them that we're also being responsible and doing the right thing as well?
Yeah. Okay, so that brings us to the end of this section. I want to, on the next, when I invite you back, talk a bit more about B Corp, because I think that's a really massive achievement, and I know how hard work that is. But when you hear the term energy, intelligent energy management, what does that mean to you? You know,
I mean, in short, I think it's using technology to manage the energy resource in the best way possible.
Right, okay.
And and helping that to help your management of energies.
Okay. Well, Neil, thank you for that bit. We're going to take a short break and then I'm going to talk to Richard and then invite you back if that's okay.
Fantastic.
Thanks. Perfect. Thank you.
Are you facing challenges introducing an all-electric kitchen? Is your electrical supply in need of a costly upgrade to enable it to cope with the extra peak load? At Secatronic, we supply advanced energy management systems that help commercial kitchens reduce energy usage, lower costs, and operate more sustainably. Our intelligent load management technology ensures appliances receive the power they need while avoiding energy peaks that constrain the system or drive up bills. Whether you're future-proofing a new installation or improving efficiency in an existing kitchen, Secatronic gives you the control you need to manage energy smarter. To find out more, visit secatronic.co.uk.
Okay, well, now we're going to move on and talk to Richard Fordham, who is the Managing Director of Synchrotronic in the UK. Richard, good to see you again. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Very good indeed. Yes, thank you.
You know, in our industry, a lot of people know who you are, but for the benefit of the listeners, because we've got listeners, you know, across the UK and across all over the world, do you want to give me a little bit of background about you as a person? Maybe, you know, like your early years and then school and then, you know, and yeah,
sure. So on. Well, born and brought up in Southeast London, and school days. Thinking back on it, I probably wasn't the hardest worker at school. too happy to have a laugh and make people laugh around me, which I think has probably sort of carried on right the way through my career, really. But if I sort of go back to how my sort of story started effectively in the industry, I think you go back to 1979 when the O-level results or GCSEs out for all the kids listening, they used to come out in an envelope that was delivered to home. And my parents picked it up and read it before I did. And it clearly became very evident that I hadn't worked at school because my dad turned around to me and handed me this piece of paper, just said, I'll never forget the words. He said, with the greatest of pleasure, I give you those. And there were my grades there, which was 4 U's, 2 E's and a D. so that rather knocked any hope of going into the police out the window, that and the fact that I'm 5'7", so I wouldn't have got in anyway. And it was a case of, right, you better go out and get a job. So I had no idea what I was going to do at that point. Clearly A-levels were out of the window. And I just sort of wandered around the local vicinity and eventually stumbled into this little restaurant at the end of the road. I said, have you got any jobs? And they said, yeah, you can wash up if you like. It's £1 an hour.
At 16?
This was at 16.
Yeah.
You can wash up. Start tonight, it's £1 an hour. And I walked in at about 5 o'clock, and this was before commercial dishwashers, and there was just two sinks full of all the washing up from lunchtime, none of it had been touched, and a pile of tea towels. And I just set to that. And then at about 6:30, 7 o'clock, things started ramping up, and this was a completely alien environment to me. And then service started, and I was just transfixed because there was the heat, I'd never smelt garlic cooking. I'd never smelt wine being reduced. And none of these, it was all alien to me. So you had this adrenaline and very testosterone-filled environment. The language was pretty industrial, the heat. And I just sat there or stood by the sink thinking, this is fantastic. This is great. And that was it. I was hooked. And I think I did two nights washing up. And then while the waiting staff didn't turn in, so they said, can you go and serve sweets and coffees tonight? So I was dispatched home to put a pair of trousers on and a shirt, and I went back. But there was no training or anything in this. So I remember it crystal clear to this day. I was doing the sweets trolley as was, and a customer had asked for a creme caramel. Well, I had no idea you had to turn it out of the Dario mold. So I just put it on a plate and put it in front of her. The horrified looks of all these diamonds.
In the mold.
Yeah, exactly. So you learn pretty quickly. But the place was run by two guys, and it was just fantastic. I was there for about 3 years. So that was my introduction to the industry.
Yeah.
Went to catering college, did a catering management course back in the early 80s. Then spent some time in the health service, and okay. I was catering manager at the Brompton Hospital in Fulham Road for about 3 or 4 years, and then went into contract catering. Hated that. Found it very difficult to work for two bosses, i.e. the client and the company you were working for. So that only lasted probably for about 18 months. And my now wife, who was then my girlfriend, we'd just bought our first house. And I walked out of this company. I thought, I can't do it. I just left. And we'd only been in the house for a week. And she came home from it and said, oh, you're home early. I said, well, actually, I'm home permanently because I've just walked out.
Not happy.
Well, this was when interest rates were 15, 16%. So wow. Timing wasn't great either. And I thought, right, what do I want to do? Mm. What do I want to do? And when I was at the Brompton Hospital, you had the sales guys that would come in, whether it's to sell you frozen foods or coffee or whatever it was. And I thought, you've got quite a nice lifestyle. You've got a company car. You have an expense account. This is, you know, you just drive around and meet and speak to people. Had no idea what sales targets were at that point. That didn't sort of figure into it. And I also had an interest in kitchen design. I'd done a kitchen design competition for what used to be Chef magazine.
Okay.
Back in about 85, 86, something like that. Got to the finals of that. Didn't win it, but got to the finals. I thought, well, I'm no idiot when it comes to that. So I was walking around London, okay, what am I going to do? And I walked into a number of employment agencies and said, look, I'd like to do either kitchen design or sales. I've got no experience in either.
Right, okay.
So funny enough, after three days, I hadn't had many hits. And then the last company I walked into, they said, well, actually, our sister company is a kitchen design contracting company. They're looking for a salesman. Would you like to meet the MD?
Okay.
And that was it.
Who was that company?
That was a company called Houghton Cavell, who they disappeared, I think, early 90s, something like that.
Right, okay.
But that was my introduction to it. And then I sort of worked with a number of different manufacturers, Masters and Andron, as was back in the early to mid-90s. Had 10 years at Winter Halter. Went freelance in about 2008. I'd worked for another company. I was working for Cooper's Bush in the UK, launched them back in the UK in the early 2000s.
Okay.
And then when the housing crisis hit, we were actually a bolt-on to the commercial division that I was running was a bolt-on to the domestic appliance subsidiary, which was huge. When the housing crisis hit, I was a cost effectively on the UK division, so I was made redundant. And it was a case of, okay, I now have nothing to do. So I thought, I'll go self-employed and just see what happens.
Okay.
And it's one of those situations where you're at the edge of a cliff and you've got to jump off.
Yes.
And you either flap your wings or you fly, or you don't and you hit the ground. So I thought, well, I'll flap my wings and see what happens. And that's been the case ever since, really.
Is that kind of where Synchrotronic started? Was it that around that time?
No, Synchrotronic came later on. I'd freelanced for a number of companies. And then I guess it was about 2017. I'd had a contract that had come to an end. And an industry colleague said, oh, have you heard of Synchrotronic? Because he knew I was at a bit of a loose end. Have you heard of Synchrotronic? And I had I've got no idea what it is. And he gave me a telephone number of a guy called Norbert Vicker, who was running it at the time. He's the owner and was running it at the time.
In Germany, yeah.
So I phoned Norbert up and said, look, are you doing anything in the UK? No. Would you like to? Yes. And I had no idea what it was at all. And he came across for a couple of days and we went round some of the design consultants in London and he explained what the system was. And even after he left a couple of days later, I thought, I'm still really not that much wiser as to what it actually does. But I knew something had just dropped into my lap that I wasn't going to let go. It was something really interesting. And Norbert, bless him, said, look, it'll take time. It took us time to set it up in Germany and get it going. It will take you time, but we have nothing else in the UK, so it's yours.
Okay.
And that was 2017.
Quite early days, that technology, really.
In the UK, yes. I mean, if you look at Synchrotronic in Germany, it's been going since 1980-something.
Okay.
It's been going a long time. And it was developed over there. They have a very different way of charging for their energy to how we do it here. So they have what they call a peak power tariff. So if you go above a certain number of kilowatts in your kitchen, you'll get charged a peak tariff. So Secatronic was devised to make sure you never got above the threshold when that peak tariff kicked in.
Right.
We don't have that tariff model here.
Mm-hmm.
Caveat, spoiler alert, I would put yet into that because I do think those tariffs are going to change in the next 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
But we don't have it yet. The issue we have here is that we're transitioning away from gas to electric kitchens for all the right reasons. I think anybody's going to argue with that. The issue we have is the grid's just at capacity. We don't have enough power.
Yeah.
You look at EVs and everything else, that's all that infrastructure that's being put onto the grid, it's creaking at the seams, and renewables isn't making up the difference. So what we have the problem of is where customers are trying to transition from the gas kitchen to electric, they just don't have the power available. Yeah. And that can be in new builds where we are at Canary Wharf. It can be existing sites. It can be very rural sites. It doesn't matter. What Secatronic does is to manage the kitchen loads within the power available, within reason.
Okay.
So, for example, if you've got a kitchen that when you look at your services schedule or your design says that you need 250 kilowatts, we will look at that. We'll run some calculations and say, effectively, we can probably run that on between 120 and 130 peak load. Right, at any one time, you're going to pull 120, 130 kilowatts. Realistically, even with a design kitchen of 250 kilowatts, you're never going to pull that all at the same time. It's not going to happen, which is where the diversity element comes into it. So that's effectively what it does. And it's a smart switching system in many ways. If you can imagine a cook suite where you've got 10 chefs and you know you've got a limited amount of power, what you're effectively saying to the chefs is, okay, you turn that bit of equipment on now, you turn that bit off, you turn that on, you turn that off. What Secatronic's doing, it's doing that automatically.
Okay.
So you haven't got the chef involved.
So it's sort of regulating the power.
It's regulating. It's regulating that instant demand. Yeah, absolutely.
So just so I understand it really. So basically, you can connect it to a kitchen, and effectively reduce the amount of load that you need to connect it to that business.
Yeah.
Like you said, if it's a 250.
Yeah.
Connected load kitchen, it could be up, 130 or something?
Yeah, we sort of tend to work on around about a 50% reduction on what you're going to need.
On the kilowatt loading.
Yeah, we've done it significantly less. One of the first sites we did, I think the design load for the kitchen was about 280 kilowatts.
Hmm.
The village it was in only had 120 left on the board.
Wow, for the whole
village. It was like, ooh. This was probably about the second job we'd ever done. Going back about 2018, 19, something like that. And we looked at the calculation that we thought, dear, 140, yeah, okay, but 120, we're pushing it. So we spoke to our colleagues in Germany. They said, yeah, 119. So it's like, so I'm going to leave a kilowatt on the board for the rest of the village. It'll be very popular. But we did it. And actually, that kitchen is peaking at around probably between 50 and 60 kilowatts.
Okay.
So significantly less than even what we anticipated.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's also, I mean, obviously from my experience as a consultant, but it's fair to say that for a business to upgrade, so for instance, in that village, to upgrade that substation or even pull a new cable in, it's expensive.
It's huge. I mean, that particular site, the client was quoted $250,000 to upgrade his power supply.
A quarter of a million.
And we've had
to upgrade the substation.
Yeah, we've had two of those in close proximity to each other, similar sums. Wow. I did a project down in Brighton probably about two and a half years ago now with a client that I'd known for a very long time, and he was asking about transferring to an all-electric kitchen, and he was quoted $150,000 to upgrade.
Okay.
And he said, I just don't have it.
No.
We're going to stay with gas. I don't have it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, Ben, hold on a minute. Let's just have a think about this. And we put the system in for him at way, way below that cost.
Yes.
And the other thing that you have is when you request that power upgrade, it's not instant. You've normally got something like a 16-week license approval.
Yeah.
Before that work potentially is going to start.
And then could be closing roads and planning permission.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So he said, look, this was in January. He said, I want to be open at Easter.
It could be.
It wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So we put the system in, and he was up and running within sort of 8 to 10 weeks
with
a completely new kitchen.
So what sort of equipment can you attach to it? Because obviously you've talked about cooking equipment, refrigeration.
Refrigeration we don't do. It's primarily the big consumers. So you're looking at your combi ovens, your primary cooking equipment, so your fryers, your ranges, your flexi pans, whatever it is. Ware washing we can do.
Right.
But there's also peripheral stuff. So we've done things like heated door curtains. We can put patio heaters on it. Heater batteries for kitchen extraction systems.
Yeah.
Lots. We did a hotel up in the northeast probably about 18 months ago. We did all the bedroom heaters. we do those on relay, so they're timed.
Yeah.
But if you had, I think there was 30 bedrooms at 3 kilowatts each, that's 90 kilowatts.
Yeah.
Well, if I stagger that into 10, 10, and 10, I only need 30 kilowatts
yes.
at any one time. So you do it on a timer. So there's different ways of not manipulating the system, but managing the system that you can integrate other things.
To get the maximum out of it.
And then wider than that, we can look at things like wellness facilities, so swimming pool heaters, saunas, car charging stations, laundry equipment. So it's not limited to the kitchen. That's where we start, because obviously yes. that's our background.
M&E consultants, things like that, then obviously that presumably exactly. starts to expand out across the whole of the project or the business.
And I think a lot of our inquiries early days were very much through the design consultants and the kitchen equipment distributors. It's now more often than not coming from the MEP consultants.
Yeah, of course.
Because they've become more aware of it. They may have worked with us on previous projects. So they are now saying, oh, we've got an issue. Can you have a look at it for us?
Yeah.
And it's very much client-driven in terms of the relationship we have with Germany is very much a family. So we're liaising with them in terms of, look, we need to look at different technology that we want Secatronic to work with, whether that's on-demand ventilation or whatever it is. Is there a way we can integrate that to work differently? And that really is from client request.
Okay.
What else can we do with it? So
when a client gets in touch with you, MEP or, mm-hmm. or client direct, what's the kind of journey from that first initial contact to, you know, maybe even having the install?
Mm-hmm.
What is that journey and
The first thing we need to understand is what their issue is. And that'll lead us on to a separate, different conversation as we move on. But initially, specifically with Secatronic, it's understanding what their issue is. And then from our point of view, the first step is running a sort of a calculation. So we have a modelling example or a modelling template that we use. And for that, we need effectively a kitchen layout, upstate kitchen layout, and a full services schedule with everything on it, from the fly killer to everything. From that, we're able to break down what the total electrical load is. That is required before any electrical diversity is applied to that.
Okay.
And then we split that off into two loads. So you have the optimizable load, which is what Secatronic will manage, and then you have the background load, which is everything else.
Okay.
So that will include your refrigeration, your heating, lighting, plug-and-play appliances. We don't optimize coffee machines.
Yeah.
And people ask us why. The reason for that is what Secatronic does is, if we're getting to the threshold of the power that we've got available to us, Secatronic will delay the signal down to the heating element. And that's all it does. It's actually a very simple system.
Okay.
So it just delays the signal down to the heating element. So if you've got a basket of fries...
We're talking seconds.
Yeah. Not minutes, no. So if you've got a basket of fries that typically would say maybe take 2 minutes 30,
mm-hmm.
if Secatronic needs to get involved, it might take 2 minutes 45.
Yeah.
It's not going to make a massive difference to the fries or whatever's cooking in the oven. But if you do that with coffee has a very specific brew time.
Mm-hmm.
And if I extend that brew time, even by 2 or 3 seconds, it's going to be bitter.
Right,
they've completely changed the coffee. So we always leave them alone. People say, it's a 7 or 8 kilowatt three-phase coffee machine. That's the reason we don't touch them. So it's primarily the big three-phase bits of equipment that we're looking to manage.
Okay. And then, so you go in, you take an assessment.
We'll do an assessment.
What's optimal, what's not.
Yeah, we'll come out with a calculation to say, okay, for your total connected load of that kitchen is, say, 400 kilowatts.
Mm-hmm.
By applying Secatronic and the various diversities that we do, we reckon we can run that on between, let's say, 190 and 210.
Okay.
There or thereabouts. It's very much a theoretical at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know how that kitchen's going to run, how it's going to be managed, or anything else. We've had situations where, when we put Secatronic in, and you look back on it 3 or 4 months later, actually, potentially, they might not have needed it.
Right.
But the MEP calculations and the responsibility the electrical consultant will have is, no, we have to put that infrastructure in, we have to run it like that.
Yes.
But actually, operationally, they might not need it.
Because otherwise, they could have had a power cut.
Blow the fuse board. Exactly. Yeah. Conversely, we've had situations where the system is working a lot harder than we thought, and we've had to manage that and adapt thresholds. And we can change the settings on the system at any time. We can dial in remotely and do that. We've got one site that we can't go in remotely. We have to do it on-premise, which is a bit of a challenge. But most sites allow us to have remote access, and we can just dial in from a laptop.
Yeah. So maybe security and things like that.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely. It's internet security that we're mindful, and we respect that absolutely.
Okay. So if people want to find out more about Secretronic and, mm-hmm. And the systems and where, what do they do, where do they go to?
The website, which is www.secretronic.co.uk.
Okay.
Our contact details are on there. Yeah, just get in touch and we're very, very happy just to have an initial discussion. The other thing that we've launched or we've sort of worked alongside it is a separate dashboard, which is utilities monitoring. Mm-hmm. So although Secretronic is purely with regard to electrical management, the dashboard that we've been working on for about 3 years now will cover gas, electric and water.
Okay.
So this has been in development for a long time. We wanted to launch it probably midway through last year, but there's bits that we wanted to add on to it. So we're just sort of working it through its final stages now. But that will give you what your usage is per appliance, whether it's gas or electric, or per site, or
in,
both.
In
kilowatt, real time. In real time. What it's costing you, and more importantly, this is the next set, which we're just finalising now, what the operational carbon is of that. So at the moment, you've got a lot of the TM65, which is the embedded carbon,
yeah.
Embodied carbon, rather. Operational carbon has always been a bit of an unknown,
yeah,
because people haven't been able to measure it. So we've been working with a couple of people on that, and that's pretty much done now. So that's a bit of a game changer moving forward.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah,
it's been a long time, but it's one of those things that I mean, when my business partner Andy and I set what was Keytech Solutions up in 2020, we changed the name last year. We had this sort of little catchphrase, I suppose, which was what else. What else do we do? What else can the system do? What else should we be looking at? And that's always been our sort of mantra, if you like. What we need to constantly keep moving.
Yeah, evolving.
And the dashboard came out of that. And then you look at all the discussions around TM65 and everything else. Well, okay, what do we need to be doing with this utilities dashboard that we've got? And the data out of it, so we've had it for 3 or 4 years. The data out of it was terrific, but it was quite, I use the word clunky, to navigate around. So we've basically gone through a complete rebuild on it. So, which is why it's not sort of widely.
Could that be on a screen?
Yeah, absolutely.
In the kitchen?
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Maybe that's a step too far, but.
Yeah, honestly. All of that is what we're working to. I mean, if you pick it up on the phone and everything. But it gives you that real-time information. And when you've got that, I mean, we've had some clients saying, oh, we need Secretronic. And we were talking the other day saying, well, actually, what it might be better to do is to, let's put the monitoring system in.
First.
For 2 or 3 months and get a snapshot of what you're actually using, and then we'll know whether you need it or not.
But you don't want to have the monitoring system as standalone or with the energy optimization.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
So it's trying to integrate the whole thing together and come up with this solution. But having it as a standalone then enables the client or us to give the client a snapshot of what they're actually using and highlight those areas. And that you can detail down to an individual piece of equipment, when it was turned on, how long it's been operating for, all of that data you can start to get out.
Okay. Well, Richard, thank you for that.
We're going to
take a short break, and then we ask Neil to come back and we'll have a bit of a group discussion, if that's okay.
Terrific. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. So now I'm going to welcome back Neil and Richard's going to just stay on. We're going to discuss around sort of technology in the wider sense in hospitality and the food service sector. And Richard, from your perspective, where do operators and technology providers kind of misunderstand each other, if you like? Do they misunderstand each other?
I think technology is moving that quickly. There's so many different things coming to market now. And I think we've been through a very challenging time over the last sort of five, six years with Brexit, COVID and sort of, you know, political climate as it is at the minute in terms of the economy and all the rest of it. So to try to get into an operator's headspace with something new can be difficult.
Right.
That said, if you can get the benefits explained properly and they're there and they can see a benefit to how it's going to impact their business. Primarily, what you talked about earlier on was, you know, that utilities invoice is probably, apart from your labour cost, is the biggest one that drops through the letterbox every month, I would hazard a guess. So if you can help to reduce that in any way, then that's a good thing. But it's getting into that headspace to enable you to explain what you've got and how it's going to help.
Yeah.
If you can do that, then great. People buy into it. There's still a bit of a viewpoint that everybody wants to go down the sustainability, the green route until you put a pound sign in front of it and it's going to cost you X. Oh, no, we're not doing that. And it goes away.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that sort of sometimes breaks my soul is when you hear, you know, you go and talk to people about what we do. Oh, yeah, but it's expensive or we're going to stick with gas. And then they come back to you, oh, can we change it now? And the retrofit cost of fitting something like Secatronic in is a lot more expensive than the initial installation.
Yeah.
If it, on a new build, for example. And then you think, if you'd only taken it on board earlier on, it would have been so much easier.
Yes.
But attitudes are changing, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no doubt
about that. And Neil, from your perspective, what's the biggest sort of scepticism around tech solutions?
I suppose it's having the belief and the confidence that when you make that investment, it's going to work.
It's going to work.
And it's
going to
pay itself back. And, yeah, I mean, I've been in the industry long enough whereby every supplier of a piece of equipment or piece of technology will tell you that it's the best on the market. And, you know, of course, that's what they're going to tell you. But how do you cut through that and get the clarity in terms of not only a true understanding of what it's going to deliver, but what's it going to deliver specifically for you? Every operator uses their equipment in a slightly different way or on a slightly different frequency, or, you know, so it's really trying to be able to, you know, tune in the proposal or the suggestion and make sure that you understand what it's going to do for you specifically.
Yes, yeah.
Because you need to be able to then demonstrate and showcase that back
and quantify it
it later on to prove that the investment was worthwhile, especially if it's the start of a journey and therefore you want further investment later on in other technologies as well. How do you sort of cement that confidence from the start?
Yeah, okay. And Richard, from your perspective, are operators, I mean, you touched on it really, they're kind of resisting change because of history, you know?
I think certainly with Secatronic, when we brought it to the marketplace, no one had heard of it. So you're trying to introduce this new science, this new technology, and in some respects, people were very resistant to it because they didn't understand what it did.
Mm.
We're now fortunate; we've got a number of sites out there, a lot of case studies that we can refer people to, so they can actually see the benefits.
Yeah,
of
tangible.
It.
Yeah.
One of the biggest misconceptions that we come across, and we have it with some of the design consultants too, is, oh, how many kilowatt hours? How much energy is it going to save me? So we're not going to save you energy per se. Mm. I can't change the laws of physics. I'm still going to need a certain amount of energy to heat a litre of water 1 degree. I can't change that. That's a given.
Mm.
But what we can do is help you manage it better.
Yes.
Help you manage the processes around it better. And we quite often, we've had it a number of times where you're sitting on a call with an MEP consultant and they'll ask you that question, how much energy is it going to save? And you know it's a trick question, because if you say it's going to save you X amount, okay, thanks very much, and the call's over. If you say, actually, no, you need to look at it differently.
Mm.
I'm not going to save you energy per se by putting the system in. The data we get out of it, yes, you can use that to reduce consumption, but you've got to have that data pool.
Yeah.
You can't just do it on a hunch. But I think people are changing that. They are changing that.
I guess
perception.
As well, what you touched on before, that at the minute in the UK, our tariffs are standard, but in different parts of the world, they have like peak tariffs, or if you reach a cap and you go over that, you're going to get a penalty or additional charge?
Yeah, you get, I think if in the sort of the model in Germany is, let's say you've got this kitchen of 200 kilowatts, what your energy provider there will say is, okay, up to 150 kilowatts, it's for argument's sake, €7 per kilowatt.
Yeah.
But if you go above that, it's 10,
yeah,
back to base. And you've only got to trigger that peak once if you're billed monthly to get hit for the whole lot.
Right, okay.
So it's a massively punitive tariff.
Yeah. Yeah,
so to avoid it is critical.
Why do they do that? You just strain on the network, just stop straining the network.
Potentially, I think it's probably more to do with profit.
Right, okay.
If I'm being honest.
Rather than actual.
Yeah, it might have the publicised incentive behind it might be stress on the network. We had a thing over here, or 4 or 5 years ago. You have a thing called triad charging,
mm-hmm,
which is certainly during sort of the off-peak winter periods. It was a way of sort of storing energy. Now, the government wanted to try and move away from that. So they brought in a thing, or tried to bring in a thing called agreed capacity, where you would fall into, broadly speaking, one of four bands for commercial tariffs. And there was various subdivisions within that, but largely speaking, you had those four bands. But from memory, you couldn't change bands for up to 5 years. So
right,
you could make all these energy efficiencies, but you were still stuck with the same tariff.
Right.
The Ofgem stepped in. Ofgem stepped in and said, "Don't think you've thought that through," and they put a block on it till the end of 2023.
Okay,
didn't happen then. Hasn't happened yet. But I do think when you talk to other energy consultants and other people in the industry, there will be changes to the tariffs. There's no doubt about it. There will be an alignment with other countries.
Yeah.
So it's going to come at some point. When that does happen, the ROI on Secatronic is completely different. to what it is now.
And Neil, I mean, you touched on it before, but how does data actually, like, help, you know, your business, really?
Well, I mean, it gives you insight. It's as simple as that. So I think, you know, most businesses would like to be insights-driven. You know, so the more that you know, the more that you're able to make informed decisions. It's as simple as that.
Okay.
The challenge, I think, with data is making sure that the data is extracted in a way that you can understand it, that it's presented in a way that makes it easy for you to then help other people understand it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, just I mean, often it's the headline stuff that you really want to grab to be able to then, you know, reach some fairly quick decisions rather than, you know, if you've got lots of complex data, you'll often find that the challenges elsewhere within the business will mean that people's attention are driven towards those rather than being able to make, you know, good decisions around, you know, energy saving.
How do you sort of line up that difference between sort of supporting the team to reduce energy and then actual, like, surveillance or pressuring them? It's a balance, isn't it?
Whether you describe it as carrot and stick or whatever it might be, at the end of the day, if you want to set people targets, you've got to have a clear understanding of what the benchmark is that you're starting from.
Yes.
So back to Richard's earlier points around, you know, actually,
it's really fair in that
sense. Exactly. So, you know, spending time to at least do the analysis in the first place to properly understand what you as an operator are using. And that even differs from restaurant to restaurant. You know, the building design, the type of equipment. Are you on landlords' supplied services or purely your own services? There's such a high level of variance and complexity potentially that I do think you need to take that time to properly benchmark on a site by site basis.
Yeah.
To then be able to set some, you know, proper targets for people to go after. Yeah. And they want to be attainable as well. There's no point setting targets that, you know, people just going to give up on because they don't think it's even possible to be able to achieve
it's
it.
It's kind of pointless then.
Exactly, 100%. Yeah. So, yeah.
And you know, when you're going around installing the monitoring system, how do you introduce those systems without alienate the staff, if you like? Because then they're thinking, well, we'll be monitored now.
No, I think it's certainly with regards to Secretronic, a lot of the sites we put it into, the staff don't even know it's there. It just sits in the background and works. They don't even know. The head chef might know, or the head of facilities might know, but overall the kitchen operators aren't there because they don't know there's any difference in how the equipment's operating.
Okay.
So it's not a case of we're watching you. That said, I mean, we can dial in and have a look at sites remotely whenever we want to. It's not something we sit there and do. We don't go and spy on people. But we had a situation 2 or 3 years ago with a site that we did that was very, very tight on power, like really probably one of the most under-demand systems that we'd done. And they had a four-week menu cycle, and everything was fine for about 4 weeks. And then on the last day, I had a phone call from the caterer manager, said, the kitchen was really slow. And I'm like, okay. So I dialed in remotely and had a look at it. And they had a 30-kilowatt dishwasher, and around the corner was a 10-kilowatt utensil washer. And I looked at it, and you can see the graphs very clearly, and you can quite quickly pick up any anomalies. And I looked at it thinking the dishwasher's been running from like 8:30 in the morning right the way through to lunchtime, but there's no children in the dining room, and the utensil washer's not being used.
Right, okay.
So hold on. So during that peak production period, instead of using the utensil washer at 10 kilowatts, they're using the dishwasher at 30, so they're taking 20 kilowatts away from the cook line. There's your problem, chef.
Wow, okay.
And if you can get the staff to actually use the utensil washer, you don't have a problem. Right, we'll get it done, we'll do that. So everything was fine for 4 weeks, and then exactly the same problem.
It went back.
And in the end, we sat down with the caterer manager. They said, look, with your approval now, we'll intervene. So we actually now turn the dishwasher off at 9:30, and turn it back on again at midday, and then the catering staff now use the utensil washer and they've solved the problem. So you don't want to do it, but if we need to, if we do need to intervene, then potentially we can. But it's not something that we're going to go, yeah, we'll just do that. You've got to engage, as we did with the catering manager, this is what we need, this is how we can solve that problem for you, and we can help manage it for you.
It's funny, because I was over in Italy just last year for Christmas, and because the sort of incentives from government, that's exactly what they're doing, is they're putting in systems to shut down half the kitchen. The chefs can't use it. They're just on, say, a Monday, Tuesday or whatever. They can only use a limited amount of equipment. Quite strict and intrusive, really. But
from our point of view, it wasn't something... It's the only time we've ever had to do it. But it was very much an in discussion with the operators. It wasn't something that we make the decision, look, with your approval, we can do this, and that will help you get over the problem.
Of course. But that's more stick than carrot.
I also think it's about engagement as much as possible with the teams that are going to benefit and use the equipment as well. I mean, it shouldn't be a them and us scenario. No, no. I mean, I think it's really important to try and create that sort of cohesive team effort and, again, education, engagement, really understanding why those systems are being put into place, and often they're there for the greater good of the people who are actually using the equipment, rather than to in any way sort of penalise them because they're using too much energy and things like that. I think there's if you help them understand the journey and bring them into the conversation as early as possible, then actually you get a lot more investment in the ideas of them coming back to you as well. They know how they operate their kitchens far better than we do, as maintenance or as consultants or whatever. They understand how they get the best out of their kitchen. So I think we do need to include them as well.
Definitely. I think that's a really interesting point that you just said there in terms of that engagement, because if you look at when kitchens are designed and if you haven't got that available power there, you're either going to go back to a gas kitchen, or you're gonna make changes to that kitchen that potentially has an impact on the offer that you're putting to your customer, because you can't offer the full menu because you haven't got the equipment there, because you haven't got the power available to it. So something has to give. So by putting a system in that actually enables you to have that full kitchen, as you say, you've then got that engagement. Look, you can have that, but we need to put this in to help you work it.
Yeah.
And then you've got that engagement and you get them over that bump in the road.
Yeah, definitely. And early on you talked about, sort of link it what you said about team and obviously wider sustainability, your B Corp organisation, which is no easy feat. I mean, that is not a tick in the box. That's living and breathing sustainability. Why did the company go down that road? Because that is a lot of work. I know that, but it's a very high accreditation.
Yeah, I mean, it happened before I joined Big Mama, to be fair. So I can't give you the full journey in terms of the choice as to why, but... Yeah, I think, again, we're quite a young company. We have a young workforce, and I think it's really important for businesses to take that sort of responsibility on. And I think we recognised that it was important for us, important for our employees. I mean, it goes far beyond, energy and...
Does it?
Absolutely. I mean, it encompasses... almost everything that you do in terms of how you work with your teams and, how you support your employees, whether that be through, employment sort of, benefits around sort of, paternity leave or, it's far broader subject than just energy sort of thing.
Okay,
so for us, culture. It was about a whole cultural change as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. And staff receive it well, or it's...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think it's a great thing to be able to use as part of your recruitment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great thing to be used as part of your retention, but also then in terms of how you able to, demonstrate that your way of doing business, is built into the culture of the business and therefore that you're looking at everyone within the business and how we can how they can be supported and whatever through them coming and joining us as a business and working with us sort of thing. Yeah. So whether that be through training programs or people's ability to sort of grow their careers by joining the business and be supported in that way as well. Yeah. So,
no, I think it's a hats off to you as a company because it's a high accolade. So that's why I was interested in it. So, I mean, Richard, What's sort of exciting you really about, you know, what's coming up technology wise, either of you?
I think when you look at, I don't know whether it's exciting, but when you look at the advance of robotics recently, yeah, is a huge thing. And I don't think that's really had...
Especially with the skills shortage, and it's impossible. I mean, it's really difficult recruiting now.
Absolutely. And I don't think that's had the impact either mentally or physically on the industry yet. But that's going to take another step. So that, for me, I think is the one that you want to keep an eye on. Okay, where's that going to go? Mm. And to a degree, it's a bit... 21st, we're in the 21st century, but it's a bit sort of futuristic. Well, it is futuristic. Where's it going to go?
Mm. I can't wait till someone comes clean the house. Get the robot doing that. That's
the way I'm psyched. I was at a conference recently, and the guy who was presenting, actually, it's there. Will do, that robot will do whatever you want it to do. And it's like, ooh, hold on a minute. That's a bit future, a bit too futuristic.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's going to come. Mm. It's going to come at some point.
Don't know how my cats are like it, but for you, Neil, is it?
I think for me, it's the sort of the movement forward in terms of sensors and that technology and how that can be adopted and integrated into systems going forward. And we talk about predictive maintenance. You know, how much can that help us to predict before a failure, when something is starting to go towards failure? And I think that's moved on enormously over the last sort of couple of years. And then the ability to sort of do some of the sort of, you know, the sort of routine tasks, you know, if we talk about Legionella testing and things like that,
yeah,
you know, and the challenges, you know, you're constantly having to remind your teams to do things. But if that can be automated and then, you know, you can take that task away, that helps you then redeploy those resources, when your labor time, resources, yeah, elsewhere. So if labor is, you know, and it is a challenge to recruit and to retain and stuff like that across the industry as a whole, yeah, actually how do we make it so that when those guys are engaged within the business, they're doing more of the more enjoyable stuff and less of the less enjoyable routine stuff.
Okay, a couple of short questions. We've run out of time, but if there's a problem you could fix overnight with the magic wand for the industry, Richard, maybe food service industry, equipment, or hospitality?
Quality of project management.
Fine, okay.
Good question. For me, it would be the ability to compare like for like when we're going from one equipment piece to another equipment piece. Yeah. How do we easily understand
benchmarking
between different sets of equipment and somehow the data being presented in a way that's easy to compare?
Yes, more like what we might see in a domestic market. I suppose they're a bit better at that than the commercial.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we've got, you know, you've got energy, you know, energy ratings and things like that. But actually, yeah, whether it's a metric or something that uses some industry norms alongside some equipment norms that then brings it together as an easier way to understand it, you know. So, yeah, it would be useful.
And again, just quickly, sorry to... Advise your younger self today, if that's all right.
First thing, just going back to my first comment, would be to work harder at school, because that certainly sort of it built me to what I am.
You've done well.
Yeah, I've done okay. But yeah, to my younger self, yeah, work harder at school. Don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah,
just don't. You know, there's no point. And finally, learn a musical instrument. I wish I'd done that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that would
my
be
little
it.
Boy plays the piano. Really well. Like we just concertly every week at home. Bless him. All self-taught.
It's amazing.
Through virtual reality, VR headset and TikTok and AI.
I won a guitar in a raffle from a blues guitarist I'm really into about a year or so ago. It's a cigar box guitar, so it was made out of an old cigar box. And I had to go and pick it up from a gig that he was doing. So I went backstage and met him, and I felt such a fraud taking this guitar off him that he'd used on his earlier albums. And I thought, I can't play a note. And I felt such a fraud taking it away from him. And he said, don't worry, hang it on your wall, mate. And I was like, I just feel just, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
You're never too old to learn.
Oh, don't have to. No, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
For you?
Yeah. I share the musical instrument, definitely. And actually, I got bought a guitar, not this Christmas, Christmas before.
Can you teach me that?
Well, I can play about three notes so far after a year. But yeah, no. I think for me, it's the importance of relationships.
Yeah.
This industry is beautifully small in terms of, you know, the number of people within it. And actually, yeah, forging really strong relationships and, you know, networking and all the rest of it. It's amazing how much, you know, coming together as a group of people, we can solve problems. We can, you know, we can learn from each other. And actually, I think it's the one thing that this industry still does pretty damn well, actually.
People.
And it's the people. And yeah. I think that's so important.
Okay. Well, thank you both. I hope you both kind of enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
It's been great.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming out, well, it's not snowing today, but coming out in the weather and joining me here in the studio, it's been great meeting you both. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast. It's good to hear about energy optimization and how to monitor energy. And it's a slightly different subject. We've not really covered any of that in previous podcasts. So I hope we've made that interesting for the listeners. Going forward later in the season, next episode, we will talk about food waste. We've also talked about hot holding and cooking. We're going to be doing some international podcasts as well. So we've got quite a big lineup for season three. If you've got anything you want me to ask any of my guests or any subjects you'd like me to cover, email me on radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is a Sound Rebel production.